Hey, Conrad, could you turn those lights on right there? I know y'all can see me as good as you want to, but I can't see you. This right here. Oh. Daniel chapter 11. Going to finish up chapter 11 and begin chapter 12 this morning as well. We begin the book of Daniel March 21st, I believe, of this year. So it's been 4 or 5 months. We'll get through it all. And just kind of tell you what our plans are. Usually when we finish a book, we do 4 or 5 Psalms before we start another book. And at times do a short minor prophet as well. Our plans this time is when we finish Daniel, that John McCarty will be doing 5 Psalms. I think it's 56 through 60, if I remember correctly. And then I'm going to be doing the book of Haggai, which is connected to the book of Daniel, or the time frame of the book of Daniel in some ways. And then we're going to go to the Gospel of Luke in the New Testament. So you can see we'll be there for a year or two probably. So. That's the last gospel. We've done the rest of them. In fact, counting Luke, 4 books, having done the entire New Testament over the last 20-something years. So, anyway, today we're in Daniel, chapter 11. And I'm going to take probably half of our time just reviewing the book. Don't know if I ought to do that, but I want us to remember where we've been through the book. So if you have an outline, follow along. We're going to chase a rabbit for a little while on something there and hopefully find our way back to the trail. Daniel is one of the most attacked books in the Bible. We talked about that on the introduction several months ago. Do you remember why I made that statement and why that is a fact, that Daniel is one of the most attacked books in the Bible by those who oppose the scriptures or the book of Daniel? 2 reasons. Somebody name me one. Prophecy, because there's prophecy in the book. And some people just can't bear the thought that somebody would have the audacity to say what's going to happen before it happens and claim that it came from God Almighty. So they have to find other ways to get around that and to discredit that. That's one. The second one was miracles. All right, so prophecy and miracles that we see in this book are reasons that the book is attacked. Liberals need a late date for this book. Why is that? They want to say the book was written not in the 500s B.C. or the 6th century B.C., but was written in the 2nd century B.C. And why? So that all the prophecy, or most of the prophecy, or a lot of the prophecy that you see in the book will have already occurred. And it won't be prophecy. So they want to make the date for the book that regard for that reason. Their answer is that the book was written by some anonymous guy who pretended to be Daniel and just told a history story of the history of the world at that time and claimed it came from Daniel before it was written. Well, that's just awful nice, isn't it? Okay, people are getting paid to do this kind of garbage. They get paid to do this kind of garbage and to get paid by supposedly Christian institutions. Anyway, one of the most attacked books because of its prophecy, because of its miracles. Now, I want to chase a rabbit just for a little bit. I want to make a couple of statements here. The first one is this: be careful what you label as miracles. That word is thrown around very loosely and lightly, even by Christians. I want to remind you of something. The world knows the definition of that word. They may use it frivolously as well. Somebody may be having a bad day and see a little butterfly floating by, and they say, there's my miracle butterfly. You know, God has lifted me up, or you know, I feel better already because of the warm, fuzzy butterfly. What a miracle. What a frivolous way to use such a word as the word miracle. And yet those same people, when the church begin, or Christians that claim to be Christians, claim that a miracle happened to them, whether it did or not, but they make that claim, all of a sudden they're honing in with demanding of you a very rigid definition of miracle, saying that's not a miracle, that doesn't happen to be have to be a miracle, it could have happened quite naturally. And they're right a lot of the time. So my admonition to you is just be careful how you use that word. Don't give the world an opportunity that they are so eager to hang on to mock your faith because of the way you use that word. Next statement is this, that verifying a miracle is not evidence of a lack of faith. If someone says they think a miracle happened, and you find yourself, if not necessarily doubting it, but wanting to be sure, that's not evidence of a lack of faith. It's common sense. All right, I'll give you a story that happened, or what I remember supposedly happening when I was a little boy, 8 or 10 years old. We lived in southeast Arkansas and grew up in church and all this. And I remember hearing about a little baby that the people were requesting urgent prayer for this little baby because it had swallowed a safety pin. Now, I remember it being off of its diaper. But, you know, diapers were not back then like they are now. Everybody aware of that? Some of you don't even know that. They had safety pins, and you folded it up and you put a safety pin in. And occasionally, for every child, the inevitable would happen. The mom would stick the baby with the baby pin. All right? I suspect that my mother's, it might have been intentional, yeah. You don't be caught, I'm going to stick you this. Regardless, they had safety pins. They were about that long. All right, so here's where this account comes, and I'm remembering this, and bear in mind, this is a memory of an 8-year-old child who may not have understood really everything properly and all that kind of stuff. What I remember is there was asking for prayer, for urgent prayer for this baby who swallowed a baby pin, or safety pin. I don't know if the safety pin was open. I don't know if it was closed. I assume, and I remember thinking of it as being closed, but it swallowed a safety pin. And then a short time later, I don't know how much later, day or two or a week or whatever, I think it was a pretty short period of time, word got around that the safety pin had disappeared. The safety pin was no longer in the baby. And they were claiming a miracle happened. Okay, it didn't poop it out, you know, they were checking, keeping up with that. It happened, it wasn't there. They had x-rays of it, and the x-ray showed the safety pin. A few days later, they have x-rays of it, and there's no safety pin to be found. Is that a miracle? I don't know what else you'd call it. X-ray machines, as far as I know, do not come with a button that you push that says insert image of safety pin onto x-ray. Okay. However, if it had been my child, I would have said, let's use a different machine and check this again. Is it because I don't believe? No. It's because I want to know. Now, there are some things there's no other explanation for it. When you do everything you can to eliminate all the natural phenomena that could have occurred to explain this, Sometimes there is no other explanation other than a miracle. But very often, there is. And we need to learn to be diligent as Christians to learn to recognize when something really is a miracle and not when it's a coincidence. Now, I'll tell you this. Every event that happens in this world happens from the hand of Almighty God. Okay? Me touching that right there comes from God's hand. Everything that goes on comes from God's hand and God's sovereign rule over this universe and this world. I believe that. But because everything happens from God's hand doesn't mean that everything is a miracle. All right, God typically uses natural things and natural events to run the course of his world. All right, remember those things. As we go through reviewing this book, I may not ask the question at every event that comes along, but you ask yourself the question either now or later, was this a miracle? All right? Or was just the hand of God? We know it's going to be the hand of God, but was it a miracle? So let's review. First thing you remember, chapter 1, Daniel is a young man, probably 15 to 20 years old. He's been taken from Jerusalem or Judah somewhere to Babylon. He is determined to be a skilled person. He's determined to be sharp and intelligent and have much promise to help Nebuchadnezzar in the rule of his kingdom and his nation. So he's placed in a fast track, you might say, to get somewhere. And he appeals to his superior to give them a different diet. Now, we may not think of that as a chancy thing or a risky request, but it probably was. All right, some of these guys may have just been looking for opportunities to make life hard for these slaves. That's what he was, for these captives. And yet, the guy, we granted him his request. They give him a different diet, and after 10 days, whatever the time period was, they're obviously better looking. Their cheeks are a little rosier, their little pep in their step, or whatever the case may be, and it's obvious that there's an improvement. Is that a miracle? No. No miracle about that. My life would probably, my cheeks might be a little rosier if I did the same thing, you reckon? All right? No miracle necessary to explain that. The hand of God in it? Absolutely. But no miracle. Number two, Daniel relates the king's dream, interprets it. Remember this, the king had a dream, and he was troubled by it, and he wanted to know the interpretation, but he knew the clowns that he usually asking stuff for, were just going to tell him whatever they thought he wanted to hear. And so he forced them not only to interpret his dream, but tell him what the dream was to begin with. And they said, oh gosh, nobody can do that. You're asking way too much. Nobody can do that. They finally called Daniel in, and Daniel does it. Daniel tells him the dream and then tells him what it meant. Is that a miracle? No, it's not. That could have happened without anything contrary to nature occurring. Let me give you a modern example of an equivalent of that. 1 million or 2 million to 1 chances of winning Powerball. Whatever. You have 1 out of whatever it is, 200 million chances to win this, and somebody wins it. Is that a miracle? No, it's not. What's the chances of Daniel telling the dream right? It's astronomical chances. But there's nothing contrary to nature that does it. Was God's hand in it? Absolutely. All right? Chapter 4, or 3. Three men thrown into the fiery furnace. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego thrown into the fiery furnace. They survive. Not even a scratch on them. Not even the smell of smoke on them. fire is so hot that it killed and burned up and consumed the people who threw them in there. Not only is there three guys there, but the king sees the fourth one. He says he was likened to the Son of God. Is this a miracle? I don't see how it could be nothing but a miracle. Has to be a miracle, right? That God preserved them through this fire. Number five, the king goes insane. Chapter 4 is a little different, if you remember. Chapter 4 is written by Nebuchadnezzar himself. First person, Nebuchadnezzar, speaking in Daniel chapter 4. And he has this dream. And he calls Daniel, and Daniel asks or tells him the interpretation of the dream. And then a year goes by. We talked about what's going on during this year. Sometimes we are warned, as he was warned by his dream, that the dream was concerning him, and it looked like he was going to have a mighty fall. But a year goes by, and like most of us, I'm warned about something, and if the omen doesn't happen very shortly, I tend to think it may not happen at all, you know. So I get a little lax and a little lax. That's the way, you know, your kids are. You threaten them, if they do this again, you're going to do something. And, well, if you didn't do it last time, and he didn't do it this time, and it's been not 5 minutes, but it's been 5 days, and next thing you know, it's been a month, and the next thing you know, they're just right back doing what they're doing. Same thing with Nebuchadnezzar. And one night he's walking, you remember, standing on his the palace on the wall, and he's looking at his kingdom. You remember what we talked about? The city of Babylon, 15 miles square. It's 144,000 acres. Walls around the entire city, 350 foot tall, 87 feet wide. You could race 6 chariots side by side on the top of this wall. 100 gates going into the city around it. If when they were placed strategically where when the sun shone on, they looked like liquid fire, it was said. Miles and miles of murals painted 100 feet tall or more along the walls in the city betraying the history of Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar standing there taking all of this in one night and thinking to himself how great he was. Admiring not just the city, but admiring himself. Scripture says, while the word was in his mouth, judgment fell. And if he goes insane and is treated as an insane man, I'm sure he's looked after. We talked about all that. I'm not going to go through all that again. Was there a miracle there? Not necessarily. God's hand surely struck him insane. But people go insane all the time. God's hand definitely was there. God's hand was definitely there to give him the sense to repent of his sin. But go on, chapter 5, the handwriting on the wall. Remember, I gave the title of that sermon October 29th, 539. There are scholars who are adamant that they can know enough of history they can place the exact date on that. Whether that's the case or not, I don't know, but I'm sure it's very close. You're standing in sitting in a banquet hall, thousands of people there, and suddenly a hand appears, scratching in a message on the wall. Is that a miracle? I would have to think so. Maybe it's just how I envision that taking place, but I don't think he had a magic marker. All right, I don't think he had a paintbrush. Says his hand was there. I've envisioned that as you can hear the plaster as it scratched in the wall. Maybe not, but I got a good imagination. All right. So it's there. That night, Belshazzar as Daniel told him. And this was perhaps the most, Daniel's 80 years old by this time. This is perhaps the most bold and forthright text that we hear coming from Daniel to his superior. He tells Belshazzar, he says, God, you know the story of how God humbled your father. I think it was his grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. And yet you've learned nothing from it. This is my paraphrase, obviously. You learned nothing. This night, your soul will be required of you. This night is it for you. And all the while all this is going on, the Persians and the Medes have diverted the Euphrates River and they're coming in under the wall. And within hours, Belshazzar is dead. We see Daniel in the lion's den, chapter 6. The king finds him there the next morning, still there. Is this a miracle? It said God closed the mouths of the lions. Is that a miracle? Not necessarily. Lions can keep their mouths shut. Lions can open their mouths. Lions can eat. Lions can refrain from eating. Lions can be aggressive. Lions can refrain from being aggressive. It's not necessarily a miracle that Daniel survived the night with the lions, but it definitely had God's hand in it. Right? Now you tell that story, present it as a bona fide miracle to the world, and they're going to tell you just what I told you. Who says that's a miracle? Just because he didn't eat him doesn't mean it's a miracle, and they're right. But we do know God closed the mouth of the lion. And then, after chapter 6, something changes. Because the things that happen from here on are not necessarily in chronological order. The very first one we see is going to back up and occur before some of the events we just talked about here. So why are they different? Why are they suddenly not in chronological order? Also, the first portion of Daniel, for the most part, was written in Aramaic. Somewhere right here in chapter 7, it switches back to Hebrew. That's another difference. The remainder of the book from chapter 7 on is almost completely prophetic. That's another change. Another change is from now on, most of the book is written in the first person of Daniel telling the story, saying, I, Daniel, did this, and I did that, and I saw this, and I did this, telling in the first person, where the first part of the half of the book, it was more like third person. So we see chapter 7, Daniel's vision of the four beasts. Chapter 8, we saw his vision of the ram and the goat. Chapter 11, interchanged here. Number 11, Daniel's reading of Jeremiah's prophecy and God's message to him concerning the 70 weeks. We saw that in chapter 9. And then the last three chapters, 10, 11, and 12, is Daniel's last vision and message all in these three chapters. John McCarty talked about chapter 10, fearful revelation. The revelation that Daniel saw and how it terrified him and his reaction several times through that vision that he had to the vision. And then chapter 11, last week, we looked at the first 35 verses, a detailed prophetic message. The first 35 verses of chapter 11, I did not realize until the last few weeks of just how much information was given there. And I brought, if you were here last week, I had a 4-page handout of the text in one column and the historical events in another. You can see how they run parallel. And we're not talking about one or two things. We're talking about hundreds of things that are historically recorded that very easily you would almost have to conclude that are prophesied in Daniel chapter 11, the first 35 verses. I've got about 10 more copies of that down front. If anybody that wasn't here, didn't get one last week or wants another one or whatever, they're here just get it after church, you would. But here's an important point. Both liberal scholars and believers alike. Notice I count that as two different distinct groups. You notice that? Liberal scholars and believers alike, both of them acknowledge that the history that you'll see on that outline is the same history that you read in the text. The difference is this. The liberal scholars will say that it was written 200 years after that, and it's just, like I said before, some anonymous guy write history and claiming he was Daniel. But it's interesting that hardly no one, in fact, I haven't read of anyone who says that's not the history. It is so much there that parallels what you read in the text that is, you just have to be, I won't say a complete idiot, but I guess I'll just say it, a complete idiot. Complete idiot to not see that. All right. If you don't see it, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have called you an idiot. Should have told you that. Anyway, then we get to verse 36. And that's where things change. Because some people say that this is a jump from, 200 B.C. or 160 B.C., whatever the time frame was, to the end of time. It's not even there yet. We're not even there yet. The end of time when God comes, when Jesus comes again, the earth is judged. Some say it's a jump to there. Other people say, no, it's just a continuation of what you read. Continuation of the history. Right, so which is it? And it's interesting that some of this historical evidence that was so abundant in the first 35 verses tends to kind of thin out. There's not quite as much evidence to back up some of these next few things here. There is some, but not a whole lot. And there are statements there that you just can't make fit in those days. Now, verses 1 to 20 in chapter 11 gives us a history from the time of Daniel up to Antiochus Epiphanes, to his rule. Now, I don't know how you pronounce that guy's name. I'm tempted just to call him Andy, all right? Just Andy. Antiochus, some people say it's Antiochus, some people say Antiochus, some people say Antiochus. I will say it probably none of those three ways. Those are all three that's acceptable, but I tend to say things different every time I say them if it's got over about eight letters, so don't tell how I'm going to say it, but I'll start out by saying Antiochus, okay? Antiochus Epiphanes. The history of the world is given from verses 1 to 20 up to him, up to Andy. All right? Verses 21 to 35 tell us some of his activities, the coming activities, which is written as coming because it was written before it happened, of Antiochus Epiphanes, who shows what a violent person, king, this guy was. He only ruled from 175 to 164 B.C., 11 years, which is a short time. And yet he left a wake of evil trailing behind him that it's hard to match. I told you last week that his rule and his reign, as far as compared to the world, was a tiny little blip, hardly noticed as far as the world goes. But the reason it is so prominent in Christian circles and even more prominent in Jewish circles is because it touched their life. It didn't matter a whole lot to the people in South America, but it did to those in Palestine. We saw this ongoing war between two of Alexander the Great's successors. One, Ptolemy, was king or ruled the section of Egypt, and Antiochus' ancestors ruled the part of Palestine or Syria. Palestine was right in the middle of that, and they were continually fighting one another, trying to get control, more control, more control, dickering this and that, and Palestine was caught in the middle. And they received the brunt of a lot of these two kings' anger toward one another. Their land was ripped apart by the wars raging between these two groups. And somewhere along the line comes Antiochus Epiphanes. Beginning in verse 36, things change regarding the unity that different Bible scholars have concerning these prophecies. All right? So what I want to do is to read them just a verse at a time and tell you what I see there. You remember, I don't know if it's last week or a couple of weeks ago, sometime in the last few weeks, I showed a PowerPoint of a out-of-focus object. Y'all remember that? And the point that I made was a coin, and as I showed you different images that were gradually more in focus, eventually you'd be were able to recognize what it was. And I made the point that sometimes our view of Scripture, particularly prophecy, is kind of like that. Sometimes it's so out of focus that we can't tell what's going on. But as we learn more and more of the Scriptures, and we learn more and more of New Testament texts that talk about prophecy as well, some of these things begin to sound like something I read in Revelation. Some of these things in Daniel chapter 11 begin to look like things that I've heard about in Matthew 24 or 1 Thessalonians or 2 Thessalonians or wherever it's at. And it begins to think, the wording seems the same, the events seem the same, and so you begin to kind of think, maybe these things go together. So I'm going to tell you, as we read through them, what I see. And I'm not here today to tell you what these things mean, because I don't know. I may never know. All right? And I'm okay with that. But I'm just telling you where I'm at with them. Beginning in verse 36. Then the king, this is Antiochus Epiphanes, we guess, shall do according to his own will. Now, the question we're going to ask is this. Are these things talking about Antiochus Epiphanes in 170 B.C., or are they talking about the beast, or the Antichrist, or some world ruler in 2200 AD, or whenever it may be? All right? Which one is it? All right, so let's look. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god. Is that supposedly going to be true about the Antichrist? I've read enough of Revelation to think that that's what is claimed there, yes. So I said, well, that sounds like the Antichrist. I'll tell you what it also sounds like about every ruler in the last 3,000 years. All the Roman emperors, how many of them thought they were God? They are demanded you worship them. Nebuchadnezzar, we just saw, went through the whole book of Nebuchadnezzar requiring people to worship him, worship his image. So it could be either one, right? He shall speak blasphemies against the God of gods, and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. Let me back up a minute. He shall speak blasphemy against the God of gods. Now, I could see either one of those do that, but I'll tell you one thing I notice. Speaking blasphemy against the God of heaven is far more likely to occur by the Antichrist than it is by a dozen kings in years past, because they had multiple gods. They might speak blasphemy against this God, but it's not that big a deal. You know, they got five others over here they won't like them tomorrow either. But it's something about the God of heaven. It is something about the Christian God that the world hates. Are you aware of that? the Muslim people, the Muslim rulers, can behead people because they're homosexuals. They can denounce homosexuality. They can do all of these things. And what does the world do? Nothing. But let one Christian suggest that these things are contrary to the law of God, and they'll have his head. They hate the God of heaven. It has always been that way. When I read this phrase, he speaks blasphemies against the God of gods. It's hard for me to picture that as merely Antiochus. It seems to be more likely to be the Antichrist. This king will prosper until the wrath has been accomplished. The wrath has been accomplished. Who you reckon is behind this wrath? I would say God. I would suggest God. It might be some of his earthly enemies, but I think probably God. Has been accomplished. For what has been determined shall be done. We've seen a phrase similar to that more than once in the last two or three weeks. What has been determined shall be done. This is obviously a statement reflecting on what God himself has decreed is going to happen. What God has determined is going to be done. Verse 37. He, this king, shall regard neither the God of his fathers, nor the work, nor the desire of women. What in the world does that mean? I didn't mean for you to answer. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers. Okay, maybe that's his national God. If it's Antiochus, they had dozens of gods. His fathers had dozens of gods. Nor the desire of women. Some people tend to say that he was a homosexual. Other people suggest that this man, this king, and they're looking at this as more the end times, that they thought he might be the Messiah. And there are all these women lined up wanting to marry him so that they are the predecessor to the Messiah. Women lined up wanting to marry this guy so that they might be the mother of the Messiah. Now, that's pretty far-fetched, but maybe so. I don't know what that means. Okay, chalk that up for one, I don't know. Okay, nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. So this took us two verses, pretty well hone in on this guy thinks a lot of himself. He thinks he's God. There's no other. Verse 38. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses. And a god which his fathers did not know he shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Now in my mind, this sounds more like Antiochus than it does the Antichrist. Because it doesn't sound like anything that I can remember regarding end times there. Verse 39. He shall act against the strong fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory. He shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. Now this is a reference, I believe, to this king, this ruler, whoever he is, buying friends. Y'all ever heard of nations buying friends? Like maybe the United States, for instance. All of the foreign aid that we give these countries, all we're doing is buying friends. All right? That's a bad way to have to get your friends, isn't it? Buy your friend. This is probably what's happening here. This guy is taking loot, taking spoil, plundering other countries, and to get someone to be his friend, to back him up, to support him, he gives them loot. He gives them bounty. Verse 40. At the time of the end, there's that phrase, that rings a bell of tomorrow sometime, doesn't it? The king of the south, and that doesn't. That reminds me of what we just read in the whole first 35 verses of the chapter. There's a war between the king of the south and the king of the north. So take your pick. Shall attack. The king of the south shall attack. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. Come against who? Antiochus or the king of the south? I don't know. With chariots, horsemen, with many ships, he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So you're seeing a war going on there. Verse 41, he shall also enter the glorious land. This is a phrase, or maybe the beautiful land, you may read. That's a reference to Jerusalem and the area around Jerusalem. I'm not sure anywhere else in the Bible, but probably it is, that these Jerusalem is called with that terminology. Many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. All right, as far as I know, probably these three countries are not named as such today, and I doubt if they will be anytime in the future. Perhaps they were in Antiochus' day. So to me, this leans toward a fulfillment back then. He shall stretch out his hand, verse 42, against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. Now notice verse 44. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. He shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. So, well, what I'm reading and picturing in my mind happening, this guy is waging war in the area of Egypt and Ethiopia and Libya, and word comes to him of some trouble going on from, you know, back toward Palestine and north and east of there. He goes back there, and he plants his tents. He makes his home in the area close to Palestine, close to Jerusalem. I tried to do some research and figure out how Antiochus Epiphanes died. And there's about as many suggestions as to how he died as there are people to give them. A pretty common thread in a lot of them is a violent death, not an assassination, but a physical torturing of his body. The people that he was supposedly his subjects all around different countries began to reject and rebel against his authority. It seemed like everywhere he went, he faced trouble, and his rage and his anger and his violence just built and built and built. And supposedly there was a disease of his bowels that tormented him. You know, I don't know what it was, but it seemed like his death was a gruesome thing. But then we come to chapter 12, and this is the same context. Remember, don't worry about the chapter divisions. It keeps going. At that time, what time is that? The time we just talked about, where he goes to see this trouble, and he plants his tents between the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and the glorious mountains of Jerusalem. He shall come to his end. No one will help him. At that time, Michael shall stand up. Who is Michael? He's the angel that we've seen in the previous chapter or two. The great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. To me, that's a hard phrase to get away from. That Daniel's, what he's seeing there is referenced repeatedly to this being something for your people. Maybe I'm making too much of that. I don't know. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation even to that time. That's saying a lot. That's saying a lot for any point in history to say what's going on in that place is so terrible. It's the most awful thing that's ever been in the history of the world anywhere. I doubt if that can be said of anything that Antiochus Epiphanes did in 160 or 170 B.C. Lots of folks endured stuff just like that around this world. So all of a sudden, in my mind, I'm having trouble putting that in Antiochus' day. Okay, up to this point, I've started out in my mind pretty much looking at things as we read them, as this happened in Antiochus' day. It very well easily could have happened in Antiochus' day. And now we're getting to here, and now I'm having hard trouble making anything fit in his day. Everybody kind of follow that? Okay. Verse 1. And at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. I don't know of any other book that fits that other than the book that God has written to keep a record of people in it that we see in Revelation. Verse 2. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake. Now we're getting even worse. Okay? I don't know of any time in history in Antiochus' day. I think if this happened in Antiochus' day, somewhere somebody would rope that down. Reckon? This is talking about some kind of resurrection, isn't it? All right? Many of those who sleep in the dust, they're dead, they're buried. Groundhogs bringing their mail. All right? They're gone. They will awake. They will arise. Notice the last part of that verse. Some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. That sounds like a little bit like the coming judgment, doesn't it? Right? The day when God judges the world. I cannot even come close to even wanting to attempt to fit that in the day of Antiochus lived. Verse 3. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament. Those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Now here's where I'm at. I don't think that these verses in this chapter has to be an either or thing. I don't think I have to choose between saying these verses represent something that happened in Antiochus' day in the 160s, 170s B.C. Or I have to choose either that, or I have to choose that these verses talk about something that happened or will happen in the future at the second coming of Christ or immediately prior to it. I don't think I have to choose between those two. I think that these things are a meshing and overlapping, a fulfillment that overlaps and meshes between both of those things. I think that some of them happen in Antiochus' day, would fit the bill for that. There are some historical records that fit some of this stuff. And I think that some of this stuff is obviously something that is coming down the pike sometime in the future. Look at verse 4, where God tells Daniel, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words, seal the book until the time of the end." Somebody opened the book, I guess. We just read it, didn't we? All right. I'm not sure that that's what he meant by seal the book, but I think what he's saying is the answers aren't coming to you, Daniel. I've told you all this stuff. Daniel has 1,000 questions. What does this mean? What does that mean? When's this going to take place? God tells him it's not for you to know. It's sealed for you. The book is shut for your understanding. But someday, people will run to and fro throughout the earth trying to figure all this out. And their knowledge will increase. I'm not quite sure what that means, but what I suspect it means is that out-of-focus element of what we understand in prophecy. Perhaps as the end draws near, it may get a little more in focus, a little clearer, and a little clearer. You know, I've been in church. I've been hearing about prophecy, these things, for all my life. I'll tell you, the Christian church has buried several antichrists. You know what I mean by that? The church has declared this person is the antichrist. Only to 10 years later, he dies. Wasn't him. Some evil, other evil person comes along, or someone who seems to fit the bill, maybe this is the antichrist. 5 years later, we're throwing dirt on his grave. He's gone. I don't know. In case you're wondering, you don't either. All right? You don't know. We don't know. There's a verse in Psalms that asks a question. You're familiar with it, I'm sure. It says, if the righteous, or if the foundations be destroyed, if the foundations be destroyed, what if the foundations of our Christian world, our Christian community, what if they are taken from us? What if they are snatched away? What if they are violently seized and we are left without some of the things that we hold dear to our faith? The foundations be destroyed. Here's the question. What will the righteous do? Someone has given a very simplistic answer, yet the most accurate answer you can come up with. The foundations be destroyed. What will the righteous do? Keep on being righteous. All right? No matter what the future holds for us, no matter how close or how far away we are from the end, let's devote ourselves to continuing to be righteous and to love God and to seek Him with all our heart and mind. Can we do that? Tim, I forgot to ask you to do share time. Can you do share time? Let's pray.